It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up, we'll raise a glass to the perfect toast.
First, we travel to Brazil in preparation for this weekend's World Cup championship match.
Yes! Argentina against Germany in the 2014 World Cup final in the Maracanã.
And there it is. Germany and Argentina are going head-to-head this Sunday after two gut-wrenching but very different semifinal matches. As you may have heard, Germany beat home Brazil in a historic 7-1 victory, scoring 5 goals in the first 30 minutes of the match.
Meanwhile, Argentina beat the Netherlands 4-2 with penalty kicks after a tense 0-0 draw during regular time. Coming off the heat of their victory over Brazil, Germany is considered the favorite in the match, but Argentina is in a unique position of playing for the championship on the home turf of their arch-rival, Brazil.
Joining us from Brazil is Wall Street Journal reporter Matt Futterman. He joined us earlier in the championship to talk about Team USA. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
Well, before we get to the match this Sunday, you're there in Brazil. How crushed are the Brazilians? Have they bounced back?
I think they are seriously bummed out. It's not what they expect. This is a country that doesn't do that well in a lot of other sports, but they always sort of had soccer to rely on. Now, having said that, Brazil's a lot more than, you know, soccer and a canary jersey, although I think a lot of people just think of soccer when they think of Brazil. So, you know, the sun rose here in Brazil. You know, people opened their stores and doctors healed the sick, and it was another day after that bad match Tuesday
night.
They're bummed out, but they're getting along with their lives.
Life goes on. But who are the majority of the Brazilians backing? It's kind of a tough choice. Maybe they don't want to back anybody.
Oh, actually, no. There's no choice for the Brazilians. The Brazilians hate Argentina. That's their arch rival. There's nothing they want to be less than for Argentina to win this championship, which they sort of feel should be their championship.
Okay,
so that would, I mean, you talk about adding insult to injury, Argentina winning at the Maracanã would be almost worse for Brazilians than watching their own team go down.
Even though Germany beat Brazil?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it is you want to lose to the eventual champion. You don't want to lose to somebody and then see that there was a team that was even better than the one that beat you 7-1. So, yes, they definitely there's also a bit of a connection. I mean, there's a lot of German blood in Brazil. There's a lot of people who trace the roots of Germany here. So there's definitely a German kinship, and it's mostly fueled by anti-Argentina emotions.
Well, they may have their wish. Most people are betting on Germany. What does the match look like to you as it shapes up here?
I mean, this match boils down to the best team in the world going up against the best player in the world. And there seems to be no doubt that over the last 5 weeks, Germany has been the best team here. They've played great. They scored 17 goals. They attack constantly. If they don't feel like attacking, they can play. They can just crush you with defense and sit back and control the game that way. At the same time, the one thing that can sometimes tear apart a great team is a singular talent, and that singular talent is Lionel Messi, who plays for Argentina, who's, you know, arguably the best player in the world. And if he has the game of his life that I'm sure he's hoping to have on Sunday, then Argentina could steal this.
Does Argentina's Messi have an equal on Germany's team?
Not really. I mean, there are great players on Germany, but you think about Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo of Portugal, they're sort of the Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer of soccer. I mean, they're so much better. They're sort of head and shoulders above everybody else. It's a little different in soccer because it's a team sport and there's 11 guys on the field, and it's difficult to win with just one player. But Germany has a series of terrific players who, when brought together under this coach Joachim Löw, who has coached them since 2006, late 2006, They really have melded together and know each other well. They've been playing together for a long time, a lot of these guys.
For people who haven't been following along, who haven't been watching all the matches, what is it like to see Messi play? How good is this guy?
What is it like to see Messi play? I mean, it's when Messi gets the ball, there is no one who can take it from him alone. For the almost all of the time. I mean, if they put, so he gets the ball and you have two choices. You can either attack him with two players and get the ball away from him that way, or you can put one player on him and watch him dance around on the ball and make you look silly for a while because he's that good. I mean, it's as if he has glue on his soccer boots. The ball just sticks to his feet in a way that it just doesn't for anybody else on this planet.
Is there a compelling backstory for either Argentina or Germany that would make it more, I guess, narratively fulfilling if either country won?
Well, I mean, I think the backstory for Argentina is, and for both teams, is they played against each other in 1986 in the final, and they played against each other in 1990 in the final. In those games, it was a similar thing. Germany had the more balanced team. Argentina had Diego Maradona. Germany won in 1990 after Argentina had beaten them in 1986. This was sort of the rubber match final for Germany and Argentina. And that in itself, I think, is pretty compelling. At the same time, Germany in 1990, Franz Beckenbauer, the great German player and German coach, declared that once unification had happened, Germany would essentially never lose a World Cup again. They actually haven't won since unification. So this would sort of complete something that they've been working on for 25 years.
To get back at the Brazilian angle again, if Argentina does win against Germany on Brazilian soil, how big of an in-your-face moment is that for Argentina toward Brazil?
Yeah, I mean, it's an in-your-face moment, but I do think it's more than sports. I think there's been a tendency for people to sort of expect the worst out of a lot of situations here. You know, everyone sort of braced for riots if Brazil lost. You know, there were no riots, and people were bummed out because they lost the sporting event. And I think there is a really, as passionate as people are here about this game, and they do love it. Anyone, anywhere loves any sport. There's perspective. There is a sense. That are more important in life, and it's fun, and that's what it's for. And people get emotional about it, but I don't anticipate, you know, any kind of violence or anything like that if Argentina happens to win on Brazilian home soil.
So it's going to be a celebration, and it's going to be a sporting match that a lot of people are excited about. You're not expecting anything bad. But it's been a fun tournament to watch all along. Before we let you go, do you have any favorite moments? I mean, there have been certain things that capture people's attention. The biting incident from Uruguay's Luis Suarez. There's been the Mexican coach. What stands out to you?
Those were certainly things that have stuck out to me throughout this tournament. I think I'm a little biased here because I was covering them very closely. When the U.S. team went down 2-0 in extra time to Belgium, you know, and in that moment, every other team in the world sort of folds its tent and says, you know, we played hard, but we just gave up 2 goals in extra time, and there's no way we're coming back. Yeah, in that moment, that stadium in Salvador started bellowing with these USA, USA chants that were as loud as anything I've ever heard in any American stadium. And it was strange. And because you were hearing it by these American fans 5,000 miles from home in a sport that had taken a while for America to really embrace. And the players heard it too. And within minutes, they had scored a goal. And within another couple of minutes, they were about to score another one. I mean, they were really, really close to tying up that game. And it was sort of this incredible thing where I think the world recognized that, you know, these Americans, they don't have the talent, they don't have the skill and the touch that most players do in the rest of the world, but they fight like hell and they're impossible to keep down. And and they will never quit. So that was a pretty, even though the U.S. ended up losing that game, that was something that'll stick with me for a long time.
Wow, you described that beautifully. I wish I could have been there. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a fantastic match on Sunday. And Matt, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you have a good time watching the game.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Matt Futterman, who's reporting on the World Cup from Brazil. Argentina and Germany will go head-to-head in the championship match at 2 o'clock Central Time this Sunday.
This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Wedding season is in high gear, and it's the perfect occasion to raise a glass and toast the bride and groom.
And of course, there are plenty of other milestones to commemorate throughout the year, but while many of us don't fancy ourselves expert speechwriters, we don't want our toasts to flop either.
Our next guest has some advice for proposing a toast that will leave a lasting impression in a good way. Paul Dixon is the author of a dozen word books and dictionaries. His latest is called Rising to the Occasion, the best toast for any celebration. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Welcome to here.
Well, before we get into specific toasts, you've got some solid advice for people who are taking on an enterprise like this, giving the toast. What is the first piece of advice you have?
Pretty much to keep the toast short. It's a minute is probably a good piece of reckoning for a toast. You have to understand people. You ask people to raise their glasses, so you've got a whole room full of people there with their arms up, and also you want to make it as succinct and as, you know, to the point as it can be. One of the sort of the general concepts around a toast is that it's really a verbal souvenir. If you think about a wedding's being the perfect example, but if you think about a wedding, I mean, all the planning, all the money, all the everything else that goes into the wedding, and then there's the toast right in the middle of it. Is this one moment of sort of grace that doesn't cost anything and is just there. It's not the wine, it's not the champagne, it's not the food, it's not the dress or anything else. And what you want to do, as the giver of the toast, you want to give basically the people who are there a verbal souvenir, a moment to remember, a moment to cherish. And so the toast has got to be, it's almost like haiku or sonnet. It's got to be precise, and it's got to be meaningful. And there are a whole lot of, you know, things it shouldn't be, which I can get into in a second. But think concise and think direct. And think in terms of the people in the room taking something home with them. It's not like, you know, taking home a garter or a bouquet. It's taking home this one moment. And I've been at weddings, in particular, where the toast was so good and so sublime and so genuine that I'll probably never forget it. And I've also been at weddings where the toast was so bad and so contrived that it's sort of a bump on the radar, a blip on the radar you don't want to remember.
Yeah, and I imagine many people want to, they aspire to be funny, and even if they're funny people, sometimes there's a right time for that and wrong. Should we aspire to be funny in our toast?
No, in fact, witty is one, it's the difference between being witty, which is being clever and trying to be funny. I mean, you're not, I don't know what comedian you think about, but you're not Dick Gregory, you're not, you know, George Carlin, you're not. I mean, that's not the point. And I think one of the things that's happened to toasting is one of the great enemies of toasting has been YouTube, because there are a lot of really gross, X-rated and embarrassing toast situations on YouTube. And a lot of, especially younger people, say, oh, isn't that funny? You know, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that great? Isn't that hysterical? And they don't realize it's not like they're you know, in a nightclub or a comedy club. And so they'll pattern a toast after something that's on YouTube, which really turns into a horror show. I mean, the great example is there's I actually interviewed a wedding planner who talked about this, and it was a wedding in California. One of the toast was had to do with the bride, and the gag was, supposed gag was, as part of the toast to the bride, was asking all the men in the room to bring up to the front of the room her apartment key, as if she was slept with all these men in the room. And this had come right off YouTube. And the guys they were all planted, come up and put the keys in the hat. and it destroyed the wedding. This was a $100,000 or $50,000 wedding. And so one of the things that's happened in this age of, you know, YouTube and Comedy Central and, you know, X-rated being okay, is that it's people don't see the barrier between when they've got to, you know, really control themselves and be about the business of their wedding and not, you know, pattern itself off some gag they saw at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And it sounds like this is not the time to pull off a practical joke. You know, that could have been seen as a joke, but just the wrong time, the wrong place.
It is, and I think the other thing you got to realize about it all is it's not about the toaster. It's about the person, the people being toasted, the people being recognized in the toast. And you know I think the bigger message you escape about the practical joke is true, and it's also a lot of it's about delivery. It's standing up there and being declarative and saying things that you really hold positive. Let's say it's a wedding about the couple, or if it's a retirement toast about the person being toasted, and don't hem and haw. I mean, really come up with a couple lines. And the other advice I give a lot of people, and this is one of the reasons this little book is useful, I think, is to use other people's lines. In other words, I've got dozens of lines in here from Shakespeare and Mark Twain, and which I've put in this collection. But you don't need my collection to do that. But sometimes you use it as an aid to the toast to say, as Shakespeare once said, or as Mark Twain once said, or as John Milton once said, or once wrote, and use those as little cushions to sort of elevate the level of what your toast is all about. Because the other thing about it is, it's about a formality. It starts with the raising of the glasses. It ends with a clink, and you shouldn't clink. It shouldn't be a clunk. It should be just a light clink. And even if you know the history of some of these, the pieces of the whole thing, I mean, clinking was the same reason. It's sort of interesting, anthropologically. But clinking is the same reason we have church bells, that they're there for sort of hallelujah and celebration. But it's also, if you go back to the early days of the church and the early days of the various religions, the devil or the evil spirits were hated the sound of bells. Bells were an anathema. It was sort of like vampires and crosses that it drove them away. The devil, evil spirits hated bells.
And so light clinks, I'm guessing you don't want us to be banging our silverware against the glass either.
No, that's another no-no.
And then we find broken glass everywhere. You say, though, that we should think of our toast as a terribly important verbal souvenir. What do you mean by that?
Just something that somebody will remember, something that somebody will take with them. It could be just a little thing about the person and some situation they were in, or a time they helped a stranger who was in trouble. Or it could just be a tiny little piece a recollection of one of this couple or the couple themselves or of it such an individual, say, in a retirement thing, of a moment when they really surpassed, and just say, we all remember the night that so-and-so went out of his way to save that, you know, to do such a thing. Because the people leaving will say, well, wasn't that amazing what he just said? Wasn't that amazing that they remembered that moment? And again, our heads are full of, you know, our memories are full of little pieces rather than, you know, our memory is not a coherent narrative. So we've got all this, it's sort of cluttered with these little souvenirs on shelves in our brains. And so remembering a retirement or remembering a graduation toast or remembering the baptism of a baby or a wedding or something, you want to remember some little piece of some verbal piece that you can take with you. It's hard to give examples because you sort of know it when you hit it. I mean, I was at a wedding about a year ago in which somebody mentioned, the best man mentioned that when the groom's mother was in the hospital with cancer, that the first flowers came from the groom. And it was just this one little thing, you know, about the flowers and the first person to send flowers to the hospital. And it was one of those things you remember. You can't you can't script that in advance. You have to sort of feel that little bit.
We're learning how to craft the perfect toast right now with Paul Dixon. He's the author of the book Rising to the Occasion, The Best Toast for Any Celebration.
This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's time for our state news roundup with a look at the latest back and forth between Governor Walker and his challenger, Mary Burke.
Right now, we're talking with Paul Dixon, author of Rising to the Occasion, The Best Toast for Any Celebration. And we're taking your calls and questions as well. Are you preparing a speech for a special occasion? Need help figuring out exactly what to say and how to say it? You can get in touch with us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Paul, we were talking before the news about some no-nos of toast giving, like trying to be funny when perhaps it's not the right occasion to do so. But you also have some other rules, like, for example, never refuse to participate in a toast. Tell us more about that.
Well, it's just bad form. I mean, even if you're a teetotaler or don't have a glass in your hand, fake it. It's because it is a celebratory moment. I mean, if you got some monster axe to grind with somebody in the room and you don't want to toast, swallow your pride into it. It's just one of those moments when, sort of as a human gesture, you're called upon to participate. I mean, and the other thing about toasting, which is really interesting, because I did a lot of research. I did an earlier, much more of a book looking at the history of toasting. And it goes back, I mean, even the most primitive cultures have some form of pledging to another, of acknowledge the other and with some vessel of some sort, including, this one is one of my favorite things to discover, that apparently the skull of the scolding of the Nordic cultures is, it goes back to the drinking from the skulls of the vanquished of your enemy. So that we a direct allusion to the skull.
I had no idea.
Yes, and there were also, the famous ones where the toasting in flagons and mugs and different vessels with glass bottoms, so you could make sure that nobody was going to do you damage as you were drinking. In other words, you would pull up, make sure you could have a view if you were toasting with somebody that might turn on you. So a lot of the toasting has to do with sort of ancient rituals of behavior and then a lot of it was about pledging one's trust when you would touch the glass and you would do that to each other. So you always want to be part of the action.
And what if we're on the receiving end of a toast? What's the proper way to graciously respond, maybe even in those cases where it was kind of a flop?
Well, I think you just nod and say thank you. I mean, I think there's, you know, it's sort of like, it's like getting a bad necktie or something for a man, you know, ugly necktie as a gift. You just sort of accept it and then take it back to the store the next day.
Well, Paul, what is the classiest toast that you've ever heard?
Oh, I it's not really classiest, but it's the one that always works, is Days of Ease, Nights of Pleasure. That's the one toast I know you can get a smile out of. You just get over to the bride and groom, Days of Ease, Nights of Pleasure, and that always gets a smile. But there are some very elaborate, wonderful Shakespearean quotes, and there's some very funny ones. Samuel Johnson, one of my favorites for a second marriage is To the Triumph of Hope Over Experience, Samuel Johnson. So again, a lot of them get to be commingled with one another. You take something from an Irish toast and something from another toast and sort of put them together.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. What's the most memorable toast you ever heard? Tell us about a toast you might have given, perhaps, for a special occasion. 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. We did receive an email from a listener who says, our younger son gave the best wedding toast we've ever heard when he was the best man for his older brother. He gave examples of all the ways he strove to be like his brother throughout the years. Then he told how difficult it will be to match his brother in choice of bride. What a way to endear himself to his new sister-in-law. And that young man is having his own wedding next month with his older brother as best man. I can only hope he can do as well. So that's a great comment from our listener. Paul, what advice would you have for the older brother who kind of has some big shoes to fill in that department?
Oh, I think they're on the right ballpark already because they understand how it all works. And the fact that they remembered and were willing to sit down. I mean, you realize that somebody willing to sit down and explain that to you in an email or on a whatever, however vehicle you got it. But it, you know, understands the dynamics of the thing, talking about the brother, talking about, and it wasn't about him. The only thing was about him was he hoped he would have a bride as fine as his brother's. But I think that family understands how it works, and they'll come out fine.
So we think generally of toasting at weddings, but what are some other, you know, ideal spots to try to toast? Maybe bring a little ceremony to an occasion.
Oh, I think just being in somebody else's house. I mean, I think I spent some time in Europe, and it was very common to welcome people to the house. And the first time that somebody was visiting your house, you propose a toast and welcome them and hope to see them many more times. And my wife and I still do that when somebody moves in the neighborhood and we have them over for dinner. And we'll just at the end of the meal or at the beginning of the meal at some point just, you know, raise our glasses and say, this is to welcome you and we were happy to have you in the neighborhood, and we just, you know, we'll hope there are many more occasions when we get to celebrate, and you know, and hope we can become close friends. And it's that basic, but it's just a moment in which you can sort of clarify why they're there and why you're happy they're there, and your intention. Your intention is to welcome them and to make them feel comfortable. And there's probably a few things that make them quite as comfortable. I mean, you could give them, you know, a bottle of something or something, but the welcoming in a sort of a ceremony where you hold the glass up and you ask for silence and such is, you know, that's a perfect occasion. Other occasions are just, you know, birthdays. I mean, I go a lot of, I'm in my 70s, so I go to a lot of birthday parties of old people and friends, it's all very common at a birthday party to come people to bring toasts with them and write them, and that's more of a time to be funny. You know, it's not a wedding, it's much more of a solemn occasion. Somebody's 72nd birthday isn't a solemn occasion. It's a little bit more raucous, perhaps, or a birthday, mm-hmm. or a St. Patrick's Day toast, or a toast at a you know, Valentine's Day or something. Those can be a little bit more raucous and such. But we, right, this is the time of the year the main thing we're thinking about are weddings and such. But there's, you know, there's some people that just love to do it. Some people that just... to just be having lunch together at a table. It's like, it's a little bit like saying grace. It's an old-fashioned concept that keeps poking its head up. When I started looking into toasts in the late 60s, I've written several books on toasting and done a lot of looking into toasts, and it was very unpopular. It was a time in the 60s when we were throwing away all of these traditions, and it was sort of, you know, long hair and sort of, you know, do your own thing kind of thing. So things like toasting sort of fell out of fashion, but it's come back with a roar to vengeance. Not
and
a
we've
vengeance,
got we've got a caller who wants to chime in on this. Gerhard in Milwaukee is with us next. Hi there.
Hello.
What is your story?
How are you?
Good, thank you.
In 1989, I was working in Beijing, China, and I was staying at a company guest house, and at the same time, there was a group of Russians there, and the Russians and there's two of us Americans were there and a couple of Chinese representatives. We were sitting around one night drinking Russian vodka and Milwaukee beer, and I made a toast. I said, we have the representatives from the three most powerful countries in the world here. We can solve all the world's problems tonight.
How did that go over?
It was spectacular. Everybody was just thought it was wonderful. And put it in the context, this is in November of 1989, and that when the Berlin Wall came down, and it was 6 months after Tiananmen Square incident. So it was a pretty amazing night.
Great. Well, thank you for that story. What do you think about how Gerhard did, Paul?
Well, I think that's fantastic. And it, you know, it is the thing I immediately thought of was, remember the Apollo-Soyuz space mission where the American and the Soviet spaceships they join each other, and then the astronauts transferred and the cosmonauts transferred between the two vehicles. And, of course, they had a toast up there, but because of the weightlessness, their drinks were in tubes, like toothpaste tubes, but they toasted up there. That was probably the first toast in orbit, or an international toast in orbit. And it was the same kind of thing where that was a moment they just paused. The Cold War was over for that moment, and they could do that. So Gerhardt's story is very nice.
Well, toasts seem like a formal and antiquated practice. I think you were just getting to this just a moment ago, but they still managed to stand the test of time. How can we keep this tradition fresh and alive well into the future?
I just think to be creative, to be, you know, thoughtful. I mean, I think it's like we'll spend, you know, again, going back to the wedding analogy or the wedding example, I mean, we'll spend vast amounts of time deciding what shoes we want to wear to the wedding or what we want to do, but we won't spend that much time on the toast. And I think that's the whole thing. You've got to sit down and, you know, put yourself in a corner for a half an hour or so and just write something that's really good. And not everybody's a good, great writer, but they can figure it out. And it's really what you're saying that's more important than the way you say it.
Paul, can you leave us with one final, charming, good all-purpose toast?
Health to everyone, from the tip of the roof to the side of the fire, from wall to wall, and if there's anyone in the wall, speak up.
That's nice. It's a great place to leave it. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a million.
It was Paul Dixon, author of Rising to the Occasion, The Best Toast for Any Celebration. Right now, it's time for a look at what's making news in Wisconsin this week.
Today, a look at the latest volley between Governor Scott Walker and his challenger Mary Burke. And we take in a story about large amounts of crude oil traveling by train through Wisconsin.
Noah Avshinsky is WPR's assistant news director, and he joins us every week at this time to fill us in on the state's news. Hey, Noah.
Hey, good afternoon. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, TGIF. Trains are carrying crude oil across the state. Tell us more about this.
Apparently, they're transporting a lot of oil across the state. This week, this news broke just a few days ago. Mike Simonson had a story on our air about it. This week, we got a glimpse into really how much oil is being transported through Wisconsin by rail. And in short, there is a lot of oil making its way around Wisconsin. As we've talked about before on this show, there's something of an oil boom going on in the United States right now, in the Dakotas and areas around that, where the Bakken oil is being taken out of the ground. Also, quite a big oil rush in Canada as well. And what that means is there is a lot of oil moving around the rail networks of the United States, especially here in Wisconsin. And so to get these numbers, to get a sense of how much oil is actually moving around the state and what that means for communities and first responders and things like that, WPR filed an open records request. It's worth noting that while the state complied with our request, the rail companies themselves actually objected to the release of that information. And according to state numbers, one company, BNSF, averages around 36 to 39 trips a week through eight counties. Another company, Canadian Pacific, averages four train loads a week of this oil.
What areas are we talking about when we talk about these eight counties? Can you give us an idea?
Yeah, La Crosse is seeing a lot of oil traffic right now, as is the sort of southern half of the state. It's basically heading, it's coming from the west and heading east, either to terminals in Superior or areas further east, Illinois, that sort of thing. And so Wisconsin is sort of in the middle of this in a lot of ways. Oil transport in particular, in addition to just the high number of trains with oil traveling across the state, it's also getting a lot of attention because of, these trips. There's accidents. And in fact, there have been trains carrying this Bakken oil from the Dakotas and Alberta have been involved in 11 train derailments and accidents. And one of the reasons why this is also getting attention is because there was a high profile recent accident that got a lot of press really around the world, there was a train accident involving this oil in a small town in Quebec. And the derailment and resulting explosion, unfortunately killed 47 people and essentially leveled an entire town. And so I think that woke a lot of people up to, the fact that there's a lot of oil moving through these communities and that their accidents happen.
How long ago was that? And do we know yet if there have been any changes to the process or any safeguards taken since then to make transport safer?
Yeah, good question. And you know, I think the accident in Quebec was, I think, a wake-up call in a lot of ways. I know there's a lot of concern among police and fire officials. You know, a lot of these trains, as we just talked about, travel through rural areas, you know, where volunteer firefighters are going to be the first responders. And there is concern that if, you know, if there is an accident, you know, they are ill-equipped to deal with this kind of disaster. In La Crosse, the fire chief there recently told NPR that he doesn't have enough foam to deal with this kind of disaster, nor the right kind of equipment to really deploy it in the way that he would have to do that in an accident. So a lot of concern about, you know, these trips are increasing, the amount of oil is increasing, but first responders haven't caught up to that yet. They don't have the training, and they don't have the material to deal with a potential accident.
Do you know anything about what Bakken crude oil is? I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about that? I hadn't heard of it till the story broke.
Right. Well, I mean, Bakken oil, it comes from an area of the country that's just sort of roughly the Dakotas. And in the last 10 years, the amount of oil coming out of that area has really skyrocketed, not only oil, but also natural gas as well. And, you know, one of the reasons why, frankly, a lot of oil is being transported by rail is because there's been a lot of controversy surrounding pipelines and the construction of new pipelines. The one that I think of, and I think probably most people listening to this segment think of, is Keystone, the Keystone pipeline that's very controversial. The Obama administration has yet to make a decision on that. And, you know, the people who support pipeline construction argue that, you know, pipelines carry the oil that would otherwise be carried by trains. And they would argue that the pipelines are safer than trains. And environmentalists, of course, would argue, well, we shouldn't be transporting it by train or by pipeline. We should be using less oil. But this is a direct result. The oil's going to flow, and it's got to be transported somehow. And the lack of capacity in the pipeline means that they're going to have to be transported via train. And that's why we're seeing this increased traffic.
Well, speaking of oil, new computer animation shows us what a pipeline spill would look like in the Straits of Mackinac.
Right. So this was a story Chuck Kornbach had this week. And we talked actually a few weeks ago on the show about this ongoing debate about this pipeline that Enbridge, the company Enbridge, owns that goes under the Straits of Mackinac, which is essentially the area that connects Lakes Huron and Michigan. And this week, a scientist at the University of Michigan released a computer animation of what a pipeline spill in that area would actually mean for Lakes Michigan and Huron. And again, as I mentioned, this is a controversial pipeline. You know, fishermen, environmentalists would like Enbridge to, you know, repair the pipeline or, in fact, replace it altogether. And so this animation gives people a sense of, you know, what a spill might look like.
And what would it look like?
Well, it's interesting. So basically this animation, which you can see, by the way, on WPR's website, if you click on Chuck Kornbach's story, you'll see the animation of actually where this oil would go. And it essentially shows what an oil spill lasting 12 hours would look like over the course of 20 days. And what the scientist found is that given the location and the currents, the oil, actually, I was looking at it earlier today. The oil travels really could potentially travel hundreds of miles in either or both directions over the course of 20 days.
It, you know, makes you think about what we may have learned from the BP oil spill. And here we have, it seems so far away, and yet we might see something like that closer to home.
And yet potentially really close because, again, this pipeline is located in a sensitive area. Enbridge, though, you know, argues the pipeline is safe. In fact, the company says, you know, it has a spotless safety record since it was built in the 1950s. So from Enbridge's standpoint, it's perfectly safe. From, again, environmental standpoint and maybe some fishermen, they'd like to see the pipeline replaced. Either way, if there is a spill, as this animation shows, potentially it could really affect Michigan, Wisconsin, several Canadian provinces, et cetera.
And all the wildlife.
Yeah.
We, by the way, have tweeted the link to that animation. If you follow us at Central Time WPR, you can find us on Twitter and check that out. Well, Scott Walker is signaling that he might be taking Mary Burke seriously. He issued a new ad attacking her work, granting money to lure Abbott Laboratories to Wisconsin. Tell us more about that.
Right. So for months, the Walker campaign has attacked Burke by, you know, sort of generally kind of vaguely highlighting her connection to former Governor Doyle. She was a Commerce Secretary in his administration. But this week, the Walker campaign really got a bit more specific with their attacks and actually attacked her record. And as you mentioned, in this case, it was a $12 million grant that she helped secure that was meant to attract Abbott Laboratories to Wisconsin. And, you know, they never came.
And so what is Walker asserting?
Right, that basically this money was essentially wasted on something that never happened. You know, Walker argues that if his record on job creation is fair game during the campaign, then Burke's record as Commerce Secretary is also fair game. Burke defended the grant. You know, she says basically that when a state, you know, has a chance to attract a Fortune 500 company like Abbott, that, you know, you have to do what's necessary to attract them, you know, whether or not they actually end up securing the company or not. She says it's worth going after them.
And in the end, what happened?
Right. So in the end, and just a day or so after this ad came out, it appears actually that Wisconsin has to repay that money to the federal government because Abbott Laboratories didn't come to Wisconsin. Documents released by the State Department of Administration show the feds feel that the grant really covered too lengthy of a time period and it really included no firm commitments from Abbott. So the state actually has to pay back that $12.5 million that was approved during the Doyle administration.
You know, as this campaign unfolds and the summer season typically slows down for the legislature, but obviously is a time to pick up and focus on election efforts. And there are a lot of public links between Mary Burke and Jim Doyle, or as the Republican Party would want you to remember. Will that be an effective tool for them in the coming election?
Well, you know, it remains to be seen. You know, obviously, the Republicans hope that Jim Doyle, they hope that that's a toxic name in Wisconsin. I think, according to the polls, you know, it's really unclear. At this point, I think Mary Burke, the name of the game really is no mistakes. And to get her name out there, name recognition for her is going to be key. And I would think that she'll spend the next few months focusing on getting in front of as many eyeballs as possible so that people know that she's out there and she's running for governor.
Well, Noah, thank you so much for joining us again this week.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
Noah Evshinsky is WPR's assistant news director, and he joins us every week at this time to get us caught up on the state headlines.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. In for Rob Ferret, this is Central Time on the Ideas Network.